Welcome to Cloudlandia.
Well, welcome to Cloudlandia, Mr. Sullivan.
Yes. Yes. And it's
here
feeling more like home. It's feeling like more like home.
It does feel like that, you know? It's so much. Yeah, I'm really getting a different perspective on time now. Like, I'm really noticing that as I'm 55 now. And I have a very different perspective on time than I did when I was 35, and a very different perspective than when I was, you know, 25. And it's a really interesting, because I remember thinking distinctly, you know, at 25, I think, or maybe a little, I think when I first started Strategic Coach, 1997, I was 31. And I remember thinking then even that 5 years out seemed like a long amount of time, like a distant, untellable future, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you've really, you know, you opened my eyes to this. I think that's evolved for you too, though, a 25-year vista. Mm-hmm. 25 years seems normal to think, and we've had enough, you know, that's almost 25 years since I first found out about Strategic Coaching.
Next year will be 25.
But I found out about it a year before I actually joined, because I had a friend and client at the time, Alan Kearns, who was part of your program to introduce it to me. I went to meet him at the offices there, and I was so impressed with the environment. The environment was amazing, that whole lofty kind of, and of course Liberty Village wasn't Liberty Village back then. It was out in the, you know, an industrial kind of, right?
Yeah. It looked like it was an industrial complex that had survived intact the war, but all the industry was gone. Open fields, broken glass, empty warehouses, some of the windows out.
I remember then I got a copy of your How the Best Get Better was the thing. What year was How the Best Get Better?
I think it was, you know, like probably about a year before you're talking about. So I think it was probably around 1996.
Okay. So, because it was.
That came out, We were, that's when we were sort of creating cassette packages, you know, where we'd have a small
book and
we'd have probably three cassettes with it.
Yes. So that's what I got. So I remember that, and that was like my introduction to Strategic Coaching. I listened to that and read that again and again. I got one and gave to Jerry Ballinger and introduced that to Jerry and to Terry Hennefeld and that's how that's where Joe Polish got.
Joe came in 97. Joe came in 97. That was when Joe came in. It's kind of funny. I have three in the free zone, yourself, Joe, and Steve Crying came in 97. So I know these dates. Yeah.
Isn't that something? But there's an example of you had, just to think about the impact of a knowledge product that you were calling it, using at the time. That was a little book with a big concept.
Gave me a lot
better.
Well, yeah, I mean, it falls nicely into your structure of VCR.
Yeah.
You know, I had a vision. I gave a vision of high achievers, you know, what you could do, and then you have capability and then reach, you know. And it was interesting. I did a free zone Friday, a two-hour free zone. And I've introduced a major new tool for the free zone called Free Zone Ground Rules. And I have 8 ground rules, and it's a discussion piece. And it was funny because Steve Crine was there, and Steve is usually in any discussion is first off the mark. You know, you present any, Steve will have a very good question about it. And so the first ground rule is that what holds a collaboration together is that both sides want to be a hero to the end, same end user. Okay. That you're already independently of each other are creating value for an end user. And when you compare notes, you realize that it's the same end user. Okay. Mm-hmm. And right away, Steve said, he said, I know, you know, one of your collaborations is with Peter Diamandis with A360. And who do you see the end user there? And I said, well, you know, high achieving entrepreneurs who will benefit from understanding what technological breakthroughs can do for them in their future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's. And I said, I'm kind of a knowledgeable civilian, but I can't hold myself out as an expert because I don't know who the players are. I don't really know, you know, the actual, you know, what the decisive difference is about any technology and where it's going and everything. But Peter Diamandis does. So what I decided was that if I give Peter an audience, he'll create nonstop content, and he gets all the ownership of this and he gets all the money of this, but I get his capability for 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the deal, you know, and we're into our 10th year now. We're in our 10th year with it. And I know he's happy with the collaboration and I'm very happy with the collaboration. So Steve was saying, well, you know, this, can I ask you a question about this? He said, it has to do with strategic coach, actually. And my question is, who's your end user now that you want to be a hero to? And he said, because as I understand it, new entrepreneurs can't come into the program and have you as a coach. There was a period during the last 10 years when they could do that, but they can't do that anymore. And I said, I'm not the best coach for the basics of the program. You know, because that was something I was doing 30 years ago. That was something, 25 years ago. And now I'm working on the new concepts that work for the entrepreneurs who are at the most advanced stages, which are yourself. And therefore, the end user for me is someone who will come into the program at a lower level. But within a matter of years, they'll be in the free zone. So that's my end user. And then I'm looking for outside collaborations that would also support my free zone clients.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And
that's amazing.
And it was a great conversation. I mean, it went on and we have 8 ground rules. And in the course of 2 hours, we got through 2 of them.
Wow. Is there a free zone this week coming up?
There's Thursday. Thursday is the free zone. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm gonna try. I'm gonna hop on.
Starts at 10 o'clock because it's
10 o'clock Chicago Eastern. Time. Right.
It's the Chicago. You know, it's the one in October is at 9 o'clock Eastern. The one on Thursday is in the 10 o'clock time zone. That's the only thing you got to be absolutely certain about to utilize Zoom properly, to know which time zone an event is taking place in.
Right. That's true. Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to that. But that's interesting. So this whole idea of the ground rules, is that something we can talk about here, or what would be?
No, yeah, well,
what a
mean, I don't remember them all because they're brand new. It's a brand new tool. I created it on Thursday. I created it on Thursday and tested it out on Friday, which is lots of time. I mean, 24 hours to get ready for something that's As you know, it's lots of time. It's almost a luxury of time that you would be finished within 24 hours.
What am I going to do with all this time?
I, you know, I'm kind of remiss. I should actually have it memorized by now. But one of them, and number two is interesting, that as you're developing independently, so for example, Dean Jackson operating independently, Dan Sullivan operating independently, could these two individuals who are essentially creating, you know, thinking concepts for entrepreneurs, you know, successful, high-achieving entrepreneurs, wouldn't they be competitors? And I said, no, what you're doing is completely independent and it'll grow and grow and grow. And what I'm doing is independent and it'll grow and grow and grow. And if we never collaborated, so let's say over the next 10 years, we didn't collaborate at all, we wouldn't be competing either. We wouldn't really be competing because you've got your universe and I've got my universe. But if we did collaborate and each of us knew how to make money our own way, it would be super creative. I think it would be super creative because we're not putting our money on the table. We're not putting our ownership on the table. We're just putting our capability on the table.
Yeah, I look at that. Like when you're saying this idea, a lot of the things that I do have, I would say, a bigger impact on the entrepreneurs that are, once they figure out what it is that they, who they want to be a hero to and what they want to do, is creating the algorithm that helps them 10x to get to the point where they are now free to think about free zone collaborations. You know, that's really the where I have the biggest impact, I think, for entrepreneurs, is figuring out how to create the engine that drives them, you know, getting to the point of being of growing their business to where they can have a self-managing, self-growing company based on the scale-ready algorithm. And that's where your everything that the, you know, the 10 times sort of version of strategic coach is really, I think that's where it meshes the most. Is that your observation?
Yeah, I mean, well, the model, you know, the VCR example that in our last podcast, the Macy's.
That's suited for the free zone.
Toys R Us. I said, you know, that's just a no-brainer, because never in their history did Macy's and Toys R Us ever compete, you know. But in fact, they have the same end user in the sense that family, there's a lot of what Macy's does, which is great for families, and Toys R Us are really great for children who are in families, you know, and I said, it's just a no-brainer. You know, unless they really, you know, have a goal of screwing it up, there shouldn't be any screwing up of this model, because neither is asking the other to do anything except what they're really good at. And that, I think and there's thousands of opportunities for two capabilities to get together, where all each of them is required to do is just do what you're doing anyway.
Yeah, especially if there's excess capacity. That's really that's the big thing.
Or they're lacking either they're lacking something. You know, that there's something that for them to supply for themselves what they're lacking is a long drag. It's a long, expensive drag.
Yeah.
And as long as they're not worried, you know, about money, you know, as long as they're not worried about money, then they can acquire a capability almost for nothing. Okay. Yes. Because in fact, Macy's had spare capability, which was space. Space and location. Macy's has spare capability. 400. They have 400 spaces everywhere in the U.S. And Toys R Us, had spare capacity that that, you know, families and children will buy any toy already available and newly created if they're just given a place to actually see them, you know, actually
you play look with at them the things. Even if you took the top 20% of the toys that would be in a standalone Toys R Us, the top 20% are going to account for 80% of the sales, and you put it into, you know, the 20% of the space, you know, I mean, Macy's giving up 20%, their bottom 20% of the space that's not selling, you know, per square foot what it could, consolidating there, you know, they could certainly get by with 80% of the space that they have in the store. Right now, it's
making Toys, Toys R Us are giving up the top 80% of their cost of space. And they're, but the other thing is that they're acquiring traffic that Macy's will have anyway. It's Macy's traffic, but, and they don't have to pay for the traffic that comes into the, to the store.
Right.
And then they say, oh, Toys R Us there too, so let's bring the kids too, you know, sort of, you know, we've got, birthdays coming up, we've got Christmas coming up, we've got all sorts of things. So while we're at Macy's, why don't we take the kids with us? And the other thing is that Toys R Us brings the traffic with that Macy's wouldn't ordinarily get, but it becomes available when they come. Yeah, the one thing that's going to hold the model together is a really good food court.
A really good what?
Food court.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, that's where that's the model of where I see the next ghost restaurant going.
And let's say you have a say you have a ghost kitchen who handles the food court.
We can get all those things. It's such a The world is just when you put on your Free Zone glasses and you, with the VCR attachment, there's so much opportunity. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, but you know, you won't even put on the glasses if you don't have the mindset, at least some mindsets that are moving you in that direction.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, I was just noticing on the U.S. has now created a collaboration with Australia and U.K. to create a Southeast Asia fleet, a combined fleet of Australia, Australia, the U.K., and the United States. And it's a no-brainer, because the U.S. has massive amounts of excess hardware.
Yes.
You know, I mean, Australia doesn't have to spend any money to create. They have to spend money on training, you know, but that's, but they can get submarines. They can get, you know, I mean, they can get anything they want. The U.S. U.S. always has stuff on the shelf. And the U.K., you know, is... you know, the UK was the global power before the United States, especially the global fleet power. They had the greatest fleet in the world for about 200 years before the US. And they're cousins. These are all cousins. You know, these are not strangers. They more or less operate by the same, you know. In other words, the reasons why any one of the three would fight are exactly the same. You know, it's protection of certain values and everything like that. And it was so funny because the French withdrew their ambassador from Washington and from Canberra, the Australian capital. I don't know if they've done it from London. They're just outraged that they've been excluded. You know, the sales of these weapons, because they make these weapons too, And apparently Australia had a contract with France for nuclear submarines, and they canceled it, you know. And now they're up in the air about it. But what are the French doing with Southeast Asia anyway? They have no presence there, you know. And so it's an interesting thing, but you get collaborations everywhere. I'm just putting that out as an example. I don't want to go down the road of a geopolitical discussion, but what I'm saying is that any area of human activity, you can see that there's surplus that could match up with someone else's need for a greater capability, and vice versa, that you could create a collaboration.
Mm-hmm. And thinking long-term like those, like I brought up that conversation about the vista, like being able to see long-term differently at 55. Cause I remember when I started I was 31, and it was a 5-year vision I didn't even know what was going to be, you know, certain in 5 years in my own life. And I wonder now, do you remember when the vista kind of changed for you? Like, I imagine now, even at 77, you've got a even wider scope, because you certainly now you have a perfect recollection of 50 years going back to being an adult still, and knowing that, I imagine that's still just like yesterday too.
Yeah, so. Well, the at 50, I was a copywriter in a big advertising agency. So that was 70, 71. And, but by 74, I had gone out on my own. So 74 is really I'm 47 years. And I went out and I started coaching one-on-one in 74. Yeah. So that's really the start.
You're about 30 years old.
Yeah, it was exactly 30, and exactly 30, and it was tough, you know. I mean, I had sort of a thought, I had sort of an idea, but what I didn't have is a marketplace that was feeling an urgent need for what I was creating, and so it was a very tough first 10 years, and it's kind of the proof of it's kind of like your vision for yourself before you have capability requires a lot of courage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I went bankrupt twice. I went through a divorce, but I was pretty, one is I had worked, I was an employee at the ad agency, and I had been an employee at the FBI in, when I was 18, 19 and 20. And, I was kind of an employee in the Army, if you want to call that. I think that's in another category. And then, years at college and everything else. And I knew one thing, that I wasn't quite sure of my entrepreneurial career, but I was absolutely certain I did not have an employment career.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I was very clear what I would never do again.
I know this isn't right. Yeah.
Yeah, I was very clear what I would never do again. I wasn't clear how I would enjoy that.
Oh, boy.
I think everybody's got an experience that hits those nerves. So that's useful, because then it's just a matter of getting smarter. In other words, I was completely committed to the part of my life that wasn't working.
Oh, that's so funny.
And I was totally rejecting the part of my life that would have been okay.
Yes. I wonder when you probably weren't thinking 25 years then at a time, were you, or where did that, what was the, do you remember?
I was thinking about next month's rent.
Okay, right. Exactly. Yeah. Hopefully this will work out. Right.
You know, and I'm, you know, I've got skills. I'm a writer and I've got good artistic skills. So, you know, I could do, you know, I could do cash flow projects. You know, I was okay with, you know, kind of doing other people's work in order to meet cash flow until I could get a solid foundation, a solid independent foundation under my feet. But it took 10 years. It took 10 years before that happened. And the crucial thing was meeting Babs in 82. Yeah. And then we really put our heads together around 84 because she had a her own entrepreneurial company. She, you know, she was a very top of the line massage therapist and nutritionist from around 78 to 84. And she was, but there's no growth in that business. You know, that if you look ahead 10 years, it's really no different from what you're doing right now.
Right. And
she got, she got very excited about my strategy circle ideas, which was the first tool, you know, it's actually the first tool, thinking tool I ever created. And I, one afternoon, I just said, I'll take you through it. I said, well, let's just look at your business and I'll just take you through the, you know, the strategy circle. You know, what's your vision? What are the obstacles? What's the transformation that's needed? And what action you have to take? And it was about 2 or 3 hours. And we got finished and I had it all drawn out on a big, you know, pad, big art pad. I was working with, you know, markers and and, you know, hand printing stuff and everything else. And so when we got finished, she said, this is going to be really big. And I said, your business is going to be really big. No, I said, not my business isn't going to be big at all. But what you're doing with this thinking process is going to be really big. And she said, I'm going to bring what I'm doing to a close. And I'm going, if you're up to it, she says, I'll join you. And there's just lots of things that you're, you know, that you're lacking. There's just lots of things that you're, from my perspective, you're not doing correctly, but you shouldn't be spending your time thinking about that and doing it. So the really unique ability concept came in very early there. And my lifestyle, my daily way of taking care of myself or not taking care of myself could use some improvement. And Babs has a good handle on that. So that's when it really started, you know. And that, and then right off the bat, it started clicking, you know. People who I talked about 3 years before, all of a sudden, around 84, started phoning and said, you know that thinking process you have? We've been thinking about it. You know, could you come in and work with us? So from 84 onwards, it really, you know, it really got traction and positive cash flow, and it was really good. And so that partnership would be one of the breakthroughs. I think the combination of the strategy circle as a thinking process and partnership with Babs was and it was a collaboration, and you know, which is at the center of everything to this day. And then the big thing was having 6 years, basically 5 years of experience out in the marketplace with one-on-one coaching, which enabled us to see how we could do it with workshop coaching. And workshop coaching was the, and that's 89, November of 89.
Wow.
And then other coaches, that becomes another huge breakthrough, you know, so, you know. And then really zeroing in on the kind of entrepreneur, which we're really into today. You know, it's not every entrepreneur. It's a particular type of entrepreneur.
Yes. Were you, do you remember anything that was the eye-opener to the 25-year framework for you? Because when you're the introduction of that to me.
Yeah.
And I remember it being a profound shift for me. That I could only
and it wasn't, you were already in the program before it happened.
Yeah.
And it had to do with a personal project that I had started in 1978. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, that I felt that the reason why things weren't working, that would be in business and also be a failed marriage, was I wasn't really telling myself what I wanted. You know, mm-hmm. I was kind of basing everything on what I needed. And I said, yeah, but that's not really going to get you. And I said, that's what got you to your present state of failure, is that you were only focusing on what you needed or thought you needed, or mm-hmm. being told by other people what you needed, but you're not really telling yourself what you really want. So I started journaling in 1978, the end of 1978, New Year's Eve. And I said, first of all, I said, nobody in the world cares whether Dan Sullivan's successful or not. So, and right now I look like a failure. And so, and I'm not noticing that this is a crisis in anyone else's life, that Dan Sullivan is a failure. So I'm kind of free to do anything I want to do. And for the next 25 years, I'm going to keep a daily journal. And in that journal, I have to write at least one sentence. That's the requirement per day, where mm-hmm. you say, I want such and such. And so it could be a sentence, it could be a paragraph, it could be a whole page, but mm-hmm. it's, I want, but I can't say the word because.
Yeah, I just want what I want.
I want it. Why do you want mm-hmm. it? I want it because I want it. It took me about, I would say probably took me about 10 years to really stop justifying wanted it and just accept that I wanted it. I wanted it because I wanted it. Really, it's very fundamental. It's a very fundamental breakthrough, you know, and it's, and what I found is that if you tell people that, you know, well, that's really great. You're doing that. Why? Now, why do you want that? And I said, oh, I just want it because I want it. And they said, no, it's in service of, no, it's not in service of anything. I just want it because I want it. And they said, well, that's kind of selfish. That's very self-centered. And I said, maybe not. And I said, but why do you care?
Right. That's a little selfish.
What are you up to? What are you up to? Yeah. What do you want? You know, what do you want?
Yeah.
And I found that none of them could say, I want something, unless they added the justification, you know, at the end.
Yeah.
You know, well, the reason why I want to be successful is so I can devote myself to world peace. And I said, the first part of it is true. The second part is fiction.
That's interesting.
Yeah. You're creating a story to tell the person, well, I'm not doing all this work for myself. You know, I'm doing this for the sake of humanity. And I said, you got to get to the point where you're just doing it because you want it. I'm just talking to myself there. I'm not saying that other people have to operate this way, but I had a problem. Mm-hmm. I had to solve it. And it was because I wasn't really telling myself what I wanted just because I wanted it, you know. And so when I met you, 97, I had been at this for 19 years. And I think I was already thinking, so I don't know the 25 year. And I said, you know, this 25 year thing is really great. You can really transform your life in 25 years. You know, I mean, you can go through a complete personal, individual, organizational transformation.
Well, it's a whole
other
life.
You can give yourself 25 years. And I said, and every quarter, and then you break it down into 100 quarters. And I said, you know, so yeah, you got this 25 year thing, but actually you get 100 quarters because, so 90% of your thinking and your effort can just be about the next 90 days. You know, sum up your progress, and then you get another 25 days, you get another, you know, at the end of every quarter, check in with your 25-year vision, come back, set out another 90. So you get 100 cracks to transform your 25 years. And there was something satisfying about that.
I mean, that's what's fascinating. Right. But I want to have something to say about that. But you, when you were talking about wanting what you want always with the reason, Somebody just showed me a video today at the coffee shop about the, it was something about fish love was the things. It was a rabbi who was saying that about somebody's grilling some fish. And they said that, why are you grilling the fish? And this guy said, well, I just love fish. And the rabbi said, so you love fish. So you take a rod and you pull the fish out of its environment and you kill it and cook it so you can eat it. And that's you loving the fish. And he said, the reality is that you love yourself and you will kill the fish to get what you want, which is the fish. Mm-hmm. And that's what we call it. You love. And when we translate that so often in our relationships, we do that same thing. What we're calling love is we love ourselves and we're doing something to justify it or whatever, calling it the wrong thing, which is really interesting. Yeah.
But even the person who says that they're frying the fish because they love fish is miles ahead of the person saying, well, I'm preparing it now because we're inviting some people over and these people are very important to us. And,
you
know, fish sort of seems the thing that and I said, it could have been hot dogs. It could have been. And I said, you don't have to add the fiction to it. I mean, if you're, at least tell yourself the truth, I mean, if you need fiction for your relationships, go ahead and make up a story. But at least for yourself, don't make up a story. You're doing it because you want it,
Yeah. Isn't that funny? I'm doing something that the reason I say about 25 years as a framework is I've been experimenting with a little Twilight series in my mind here that what I'm doing is each night as I go to bed or, when you're kind of thinking your way to sleep or your mind is still kind of going, I've been playing a series in my mind. I've been looking back. I've been revisiting one year starting in 1976, going back that love from when I was 10 kind of thing going forward and revisiting as much as I can remember about that year. And then the next night I'll think about 1977 and 1988. And I've been doing that now. I'm up to 1990 now. I've been doing it for about 12 days. And it's a really interesting thing.
Oh, it's great.
How much, like, when you sit and think about a thing, I think about how many lives I've lived in my 55 years here,
Well, the other thing is the memories are there, but they're not accessible. But they're not accessible unless you have a reason for bringing them forward.
Right.
You've just given yourself a reason for bringing forward a year's worth of experience, and not the year before or the year after, but just that year.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's what I'm
and the memories are there because they're connected to each other.
Right.
And the other thing is you're making them up fresh anyway, and you're bringing to the surface and taking a look at things which happened 30 years ago or 25 years ago.
Yeah.
But you're bringing them forward, only those that are really useful to you now and useful into the future.
Right. Yeah. And so my intention is to go this series all the way forward to today and then imagine it out into the future, to imagine what are the, next year and the year after, like what can I imagine or see 10 years from now? Like what's really going to change,
What's great about this is let's just say when you're, you know, you've completed 25 years on this.
Yeah.
And here's what I can guarantee will happen. You'll have some real zingers for every year. Like there'll be a zinger. There'll be a decision, an action, or an outcome every year. And then you'll say, and each of these years has a fundamental lesson that, without realizing it until I did this exercise, that is actually a foundation of how I'm looking at my future, looking at my future. And I have to tell you, you get a million people who'd want to know about this, but only because we're living in Cloudlandia.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah.
Otherwise, you're just boring the shit out of your neighbors in celebration.
Right. That's so funny.
If you're asking them to listen, you better be giving them free food, Dean.
Yeah, right. No, you're the only one I've told about this. I mean, that's because I know you can appreciate it. But that, so, you know, 1990, I'm up to, but, you know, 1988 was a pivotal year because that's, I mean, I remember so clearly being on Lars Ekdahl's boat with my doubles partner, Johan, and having a philosophical conversation about the, you know, shrinking runway of a tennis player and how, you know, Lars went through that same thing. And the words that he came to for him were, you know, I wonder what the 180th ranked businessman in the world is making right now. And he decided to switch games and get into the business game. He was sharing that as wisdom to Johan and I. And that, to me, that was 100% the right words at the right time.
Oh,
and that was in the spring. That was in the spring of 1988. And I immediately went back to Canada, arranged to get my real estate license. And by November of 1988, I was a newly minted real estate agent at 21, setting up to play the longest game. As you know, and that was an advantage then. I was able to thought about myself because our contemporaries at the time, some of the tournaments I was playing in, you know, we were playing and Andre Agassi was just coming out, you know, making his kind of debut. This kid with blue hair and crushing it. That was in the mid 80s. And so all these kids. So I looked at it that at 21, starting in business, I dropped out of college and got going. And that would have given, you know, a 2 year, felt like I was a 2 year head start on being a business prodigy with a long runway. That was my first introduction to thinking, you know, kind of on the big picture that there's no, I can go as fast as I can. And my youth or my age is an advantage, not a disadvantage, because it's only going to get more and more valuable. Well, that was a fun revisit for my 1988.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. Athletes are a good example of it, and child stars or teenage stars in the entertainment business are a good example of it. Mm-hmm. And that is, they get they're successful before they appreciate their success. You know, and that happens with athletes too. You know, that they have this high point, and that, you know, I mean, if they're really good, they're, you know, they're certainly nationally known, or they're in some sports, they're known throughout the world. And it can happen, you know, like you're 25 years old and you're world famous and you've been at the top. And the problem is you look ahead and you know, there's people who live 50, 60 years longer than you are right now. And is there anything you're going to do that's as good and as exciting as what you've already done.
Right.
And I've met him. I mean, I've met, I have over the last, 47 years of coaching entrepreneurs, I've probably met two dozen, entrepreneurs who were top of the line, not entertainers so much, but athletes. They, they played in the National Football League. They, they were they played on Major League Baseball teams and everything like that. And it's an advantage to them in what they're doing right now. Because it opens doors, in other words, somebody played in a World Series, played for, a professional, one of the Major League Baseball teams, and that'll open their door, but it doesn't really have anything to do with the occupation that they're doing right now. Okay. Yeah. And people don't want to hear about what their profession is. They want to hear the stories of their previous life.
Yes. Yeah,
and they're forced and it's to a live sad, back. And it's a sad thing. It's a very sad thing. And I've watched them, and not the same thing, but a different, totally different previous experience. When I joined the ad agency in Toronto, 1971, June of 1971. This was the number two agency in Canada, never became number one, but number two was big. It was coast to coast. Mm-hmm. They had offices in, 10 cities and it was big for Canada. And so you have your copywriters, you have your artists, you have your all the different skills that are required to be a successful corporation. But there was one guy here, and he was the traffic manager for all the production of the work. And so, in other words, he had an overview of all the different projects and what the deadlines were. And his job was just to keep everybody on schedule so that the projects could be finished. And he was a Brit. He had emigrated from the UK. 70s, maybe he did it in the 50s. I don't know what his history was. But when you walked into his office, all his pictures were of young men with Spitfires, because when he was 18, 19 years old, he had been one of the few, the Winston Churchill's the few who saved Britain from the Germans, the Spitfire and Hurricane pilots. Right. He was one of them. And you saw pictures of him. It was hard to see him because he had put on about, he wasn't the lean, muscular warrior that he had been at 18 or 19. And the other thing is, he said, you see this person? He says, there's 10 of us here. He says, 5 of them were dead within 6 months after the picture was taken. And he was telling all these, these stories. And I just got the sense I had this real... I could sense his sadness, and it was kind of sad that nothing in this man's life was ever going to match the importance and the meaning of what had already happened to him by the time he was 20 years old.
Right. Yeah, that's wild, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of like thinking about those being like a one-hit wonder. Musically.
I was watching YouTube last night. One hit wonder.
Yeah.
I Will Survive.
I Will Survive. Okay. Gloria Gaynor.
Was number one. She was number one. I Will Survive. Uh-huh. Went right to the top of the hit charts. And if you're going to have if you're a one hit wonder, make sure it's number. Make sure it's not the number 10 hit. Make sure it's the number one.
Number one. Yeah.
Because 35 years later, they're bringing on Gloria Gaynor, and she's singing "I Will Survive," and the whole audience goes crazy. And my Kathy Davis, who's my great internal partner on producing workshop materials.
Yeah.
She's got it as her cell phone answer. That somebody calls her It's Gloria Gaynor.
I just saw the thing. What made me think of that was it's Rick Springfield's birthday was recently. He's 72 mm-hmm. years old. 72 years old. And his Jesse's Girl song, you know, you think about, you mm-hmm. know, he had a string of three or four hits in that 4-year period there from 1980 yeah. to 1984. But, you know, the YouTube thing was showing him at 72 out playing Jesse's Girl. You know, he's lived his whole life just dining out on Jesse's Girl. Have you heard that in the, that saying in the South, dining out? Like if you got a good, you're a good, you got good stories, you could dine out. I mean, people would want to take you out for dinner to so you've been dining yeah. out on that, on his Jesse's Girl.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it's, and yeah, I mean, you know, fame has its own value. You know what I mean?
That's, yeah.
Yeah. And I think there's a skill that goes along with it. You know, like nobody, yeah. not everybody has the skill of being able to be famous.
Yes.
But my feeling is that most of the people who have it don't know what it is.
Right. Yeah, that was, I mean, the best thing ever, though. There was there's actually a show on VH1 called One Hit Wonders, and it's kind of like a Where Are They Now, and
yeah.
it was some, I don't know who it was, because I wish I could credit them with saying it, but they asked them, you know, how does it feel like having just had the one hit, you know, like implying that he must feel like a letdown, you know, that you didn't really go on to big success. And they totally reframed it and said, listen, you know, in the big picture of music success, one hit wonder is pretty high up there. And we've been able to, all we ever wanted to do was not have jobs and play music. And I've been able to do that my whole life because of that one hit. So I'm pretty happy about it. I don't think about it as a success. Everybody knows
their name. You know something? You started this podcast, though, talking about your different relationship with time now in the 1990s. And my sense is that you can strive for the one hit wonder. Or you can say, I'm going to use the next 25 years with 100 quarters just to transform my life into everything I wanted. And that doesn't have anything whatsoever to do with having a number one hit.
Yeah. That's true.
I mean, I find one hit wonders a bit like hoping that the lottery winner today is your number. You know, it's hoping that you have enormous luck today. And I said, if you have to, I think, you know, luck is luck, you know, and, you know, and I'm not knocking it. I don't want to have bad luck.
But, right.
It's not the main thing I'm trying to master in life is luck. I'm trying to master real uniquely valuable skill that other people will pay for.
But even luck requires action. And that's the interesting thing about it, right? It's that you're putting yourself in a situation where luck is going to pay off. Luck can only pay off if you
I mean, that's, you know, if you want to score a goal, you have to take the shot, you know what I mean?
That's right.
I mean, the great Canadian philosopher Wayne Gretzky said that he missed all the shots that he didn't take.
But you imagine, Dan, if you could get in the hot tub time machine and go back and actually revisit each of those years for that time frame, you know, knowing, you know, that you were on the right track with certain things, or that you made the right, you know, choice, or you being able to confidently go all in on a choice that maybe you delayed for a period of time.
August 13th, 1982. 7 o'clock. That's the moment I met Babs.
Oh, wow. There it is.
Yep. There's before that, all my years before that.
Yeah.
There's all my years after that.
Wow. That's something. That's awesome.
Yeah.
free zone collaboration.
Yep. And great. I mean, great thing. But I love what you're doing. And I think, you know, it'll be interesting to kind of create some categories of the big gains. The big gains from each of the years, you know. And I think you'll have a major piece of intellectual capital when you finish all 25 years.
Yeah. Well, we're at 1990 now, so by next week, Dan, we'll be right up to when we met.
Yep.
There we go.
Yeah. I'll have if you come to the workshop next Thursday, I'll have you chat about it.
Yeah. Okay, I will.
Yeah, and here's the neat thing about what you're doing. Who's to argue with you?
Right, exactly. And I mean, that's the thing is, I'm probably arguing, you know, I don't know how reliable our memories are. I think it's been proven that we reshape our memories, you know.
Dean, I'm going to give you a different perspective. The only question is, how creative is your memory?
Right. There you go. Perfect. How creative is your memory?
Yeah.
That's the
always remember, entertainment trumps accuracy.
That's right. If you're going to dine out on a memory,
and who's to prove you? And who's to prove you wrong? It's like, talking to at the opportunity where Joe Polish introduced me to what's his name?
Richard Branson?
No, Cooper, the singer, the entertainer. Oh, Alice Cooper and his wife. And we got into the fact that he has a late night Sirius, you know, the satellite network. It's Nighttime with Alice Cooper, where he retells the history of rock and roll, 50s, 60s. And I listened to it a couple of nights, and he's terrific. I mean, he's just got a terrific style, and he's a great storyteller and everything else. And I asked him why he does it, and he says, well, first of all, it's therapeutic. He says, you know, going back, he's doing what you're doing right now. You know, he was doing, and he said, the other thing is, it's really neat. He says, I can say anything I want because all the other witnesses are dead.
He's the keeper of the memories. That's right.
Yeah, he says anything I say about it. It's like Winston Churchill, at the end of the Second World War. They said, "How do you think history will treat you?" He says, "I think history's going to treat me really well, and the reason is because I'm going to be the one that writes the history."
So that's great. I love it. That is so funny.
You're writing your history. You're writing your history, Dean.
I am.
Yeah.
I am indeed.